This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Later in the show, financial advice for kids on turning $100 into $1 million. First, this is National Financial Literacy Month, also known as National Financial Capability Month. During April, social service agencies, financial institutions, and educational groups work to raise awareness about the need for financial education. Joining us to discuss what we should all know about money, credit, finances, and improving efforts to teach financial literacy, our Director for School Relations with the Economic Center at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Valerie Crewe, Hamilton City School District ESL Coordinator and Social Studies Coach, and a member of the Teacher Advisory Board with the Ohio Jumpstart Coalition, Corbin Moore, and Chris DeSimio, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Corbin, Val, and Chris, thanks for being here this afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Sure.
It's always a pleasure. Always.
Chris, what in terms of numbers, I mean, we got some looks at industrial production. What are those numbers showing?
Well, the biggest number of the week so far, forgetting for a minute the earnings parade, which kicked off in earnest, which is a small little suburb just north of it started on Monday after the opening. The earnings have been coming out. They're okay, not as bad as people had feared.
The banks are doing all right.
The bar has been set low for earnings expectations, so that's always a good thing. But overnight, during the middle of the week, China reported that its exports had grown at double-digit rates. And for people who were concerned that the Chinese economy was going to end up like the fourth ship in Columbus's flotilla, the one that fell off the edge of the world, the one no one talks about anymore, that kind of put that to bed. And so you had massive rallies in Japan, just gigantic rallies overnight in Japan and other Asian markets. And that kind of gave a lift to U.S. equity prices. So we had double-digit gains in midweek, a slight gain yesterday. And today, who knows? I mean, it's one. Here it is, you know, April 15th, a little after 1 o'clock. And they're down. The Dow's down about 27 points. But you're getting good movement in technology. And a number fresh off the ticker tape, for anyone who watches the ticker tape, the rig count, the number of rigs operating. People used to not pay attention to that. Yeah, it's a big deal. It fell by three. There are only 351 oil rigs drilling in the United States right now. 351, down from four figures, down from over 1,000. And so if you're wondering, well, what's going to happen to the price of oil? Clearly, there's going to be less coming out if they're not drilling as much. And so that's put a floor under the price of oil. So for people who were worried that oil was going to go to 20 and then down to 10, and well, it's around $40 a barrel now. It's down a little bit today, but there have been some big gains in the energy market too. So the markets have been thankful that things are stabilizing. So we've also seen we have witnessed a decoupling. It used to be that stocks would wait to see if oil was going to get crushed. When oil didn't get crushed or oil went up, then stocks would go up. Well, but you know, there have been days when stocks have gone up a lot and oil did nothing. So finally, the linkage, the normal relationships are coming back into play. But the kind of thing that when you're teaching people of all ages financial literacy, it's how to digest and absorb and put to work all this disparate information.
What's important and what's not.
Exactly. What's noise? What's selling? What's trying to sell books or commercials? And what's really useful?
Yeah. And speaking of China now, their GDP came in at, I think it was 6.7%.
Yes.
And we actually think this is a reliable number this time.
It's really up in the air. I mean, keep in mind that China remains a command economy. And there were articles years ago published in the Wall Street Journal and other reputable sources to the effect that, you know, how the government had mandated that businesses shut down ahead of the Olympics in Beijing in 2008, and it may have been what led to the slowdown this summer. If you look at the pictures of what was going on at the parade in China in September, clear blue skies. Well, that's not a normal thing in Beijing. And so it takes about, at least in 2008, it took about 7 weeks of shutting the economy down, shutting the factories down to clear the air so that the pictures would look nice. And so how much of the slowdown of the growth rate is manufactured and how much is real? It's yeah, it's anyone's guess. But you really got to look at those numbers and try to determine a pattern. And so a lot of investors will look at the numbers from companies that sell stuff to China, or Chinese companies or Asian companies in the China region that are selling things to Apple, for example, to get an idea of what's going on there.
And we got some really good news yesterday, the weekly jobless claims. Came in at a remarkable level.
One of the lowest numbers in years. And yet, the market did nothing with it because we're heading into the weekend. The employment reports have been uniformly good over the weekend, not this weekend, but last weekend. Gene Epstein, maybe it was the weekend before that, in Barron's, made a very interesting point. And what he pointed out was that the American economy, just as part of the natural, what do you call, creative destruction, destroys about 800,000 jobs. So when you see that 200,000 jobs were created, what that really means is that there were a million new jobs created, 200,000 more than the 800,000 that were lost. And so normally speaking, there are jobs being lost all the time as buggy whip manufacturers shut down and they start making cars. So it's part of the process. And this, again, Gene Epstein is the economics editor at Barron's and writes a wonderful column.
And I think the number was 253,000 claims, jobless claims. And that was the lowest since early 70s, 73, I think.
I think since Leisure Suits came out, yes. A leisure suit, people working in the leisure suit industry are out of a job too.
And meantime, the Dow is almost at 18,000. It's closing in on that.
It is tiptoeing, it's sneaking up on the all-time
little
highs.
By little.
Which were reached in May a year ago.
And of course, Chris, today is April 15th. And if you're sweating, oh my gosh, I have to file my taxes. No.
That's correct.
Not yet.
That's correct, because the Emancipation Day in the District of Columbia is a holiday there. And when that falls on a weekend near tax time, then that day becomes the deadline. And so that's what it is. It's also, of course, the day that Abraham Lincoln passed away, April 15th. So connecting the death of our 16th president and the filing of taxes is always kind of an odd thing, but it happens to be true.
Yeah, so we get a couple extra days.
A couple extra days.
Federal holiday.
Exactly. And you have until Monday to file your extension if you haven't done so yet.
So what's your advice to people who are oh my gosh, I got to do this. Where do you start?
Well, for those who remember saying, we've been warning people for years, if you don't do your taxes until the end, the very first really great weekend weather-wise of the year will be the weekend that taxes are due.
And of course.
So here we are. Here we are. Now, the important thing is to, you know, first of all, don't do your taxes in a rush. If you need to file an extension, file an extension. However, the important thing is to ask yourself the question, why am I doing my taxes on April 18th? How do I get out of this pattern? Is there a better way to do it? Can I be making some – are there some conscious decisions that can be made throughout the year that will make it more orderly and perhaps less unprofitable for you?
It shows the importance of good record keeping and being prepared.
And it comes back to financial literacy indeed, because unfortunately there will be people who will – come up a little shy on their taxes, and they'll have to resort to lending options that are not exactly favorable.
Yeah. Well, and speaking, if you come up short on your taxes, one of the rules pieces of advice for last minute filers is to file even if you can't pay, because my understanding is the penalty for not filing is a lot higher than the penalty for not paying. So even if you think you can't afford it, get the paperwork done.
Right. It's better for you to file and stay in touch with the IRS than for them to have to come looking for you. Because if they have to come looking for you, and they won't look for you by email. Keep in mind, they won't look for you by email. They won't. They will. You'll get a letter. But if they have to bring it to your attention, then it's usually not as easy to fix as if you bring it to their attention.
Any other advice for folks who've waited to the last minute? Don't do it again.
Well, besides that, really, it gets to what we're going to be talking about today. It's financial literacy is for everyone. It should be taught in the schools. It should be taught from the very beginning, from early age. And it's something that if you have kids or grandchildren, teach them, and teaching other teaching the next generations actually helps you become a better learner yourself. So just because you may have graduated from college 20, 30 years ago doesn't mean that you can stop learning. It's for everyone.
Oh, Val, what does it mean when someone says financial literacy? What does it mean to be financially literate?
The actual word that comes to mind is the word responsible. Responsibility is a wonderful ethic to espouse to, but quite honestly, creating responsibility and that being around the area of financial literacy specific to this topic is one that just allows a person to take ownership and to own their money and not let their money own them. And doing that at a younger and younger age and using every teachable moment when you're in the grocery store, when you're out running errands, when you are holding your grandchild's hand and taking them to some new area and teaching them about the responsibility of the world that they are going to go into. It's a civic responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Corbin, what about you? What does financial literacy mean to you?
Pretty much piggybacking on what Val said, it's good citizenship. It's having that personal responsibility. It's knowing those things that may not be the most exciting, but this is life knowledge and skills that you need to navigate your way through life and to find that financial future. It's all planning. It's knowing the insides and outs. What do I do with a credit card? How do I make a good purchase? How do I save for a house? It's just a solid part of life and good citizenship.
You know, speaking of having a credit card, Corbin and Val, I was reading that total outstanding U.S. consumer debt is at $3.4 trillion. So I'm sitting here wondering, is financial literacy something that's going to help us avoid racking up so much debt?
That is certainly something that we have as part of our message to students, just even something as simple as explaining the difference between a debit and a credit card is something that the younger that you can teach a child or even high school students through their financial literacy courses to let them know that there is a tremendous difference. And once again, it's that responsibility of knowing how to use one, because there's nothing wrong with a credit card. It's whether you abuse it and utilize it to purchase the things that are possibly unnecessary, and you could go another route in order to buy it.
Yeah. It's important to keep in mind that when talking about credit, to understand what the true cost of credit is and to realize that whether you're putting money on a credit card to, you know, buy groceries or to buy fill up your tank, that money has to be paid back. So, a penny borrowed is not a penny earned. It has to be. It's not earned yet. It's got to be paid back. And some people have misunderstand that, and they think that, well, I just keep borrowing and borrowing. And then it's easy to end up in that unending cycle, almost like a pinball, caught between the flippers. You're going back and forth. You're from one bill to another. And you can see one of the warning signs, at least, is if your interest rates continue to get higher and higher. And if you're afraid to check your credit score or you're afraid to answer the phone or open the mail, that's a sign that something's wrong and that you need to get your hands around your credit situation.
And I would add that, you know, this is a shared responsibility for parents and their children and the school. And more times than the kids hear it, that it becomes ingrained in part of what they do. And late last year in 2015 in November, the State Board of Education passed new financial literacy standards and a model curricula, and there's a bill right now, it's House Bill 383, to make that a required course at the high school beyond being what the current law is, where it's just integrated into a government class or another class, maybe a math class or another class at the high school level.
We will continue our conversation about financial literacy, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining us as we discuss financial literacy, Director for School Relations with the Economic Center at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Valerie Crewe, Hamilton City School District ESL Coordinator and Social Studies Coach, and a member of the Teacher Advisory Board with the Ohio Jumpstart Coalition, Corbin Moore, and Krista Simeo, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. Corbin, tell me a little bit about the Jumpstart Coalition. What is that all about?
The Jumpstart Coalition is a national organization, and each state has an alliance. And in Ohio, the Ohio Jumpstart Teaching Alliance is going to have a conference, a free conference for teachers. It's fully sponsored by our partners, which include Fidelity and Visa and Park National Bank and the Ohio Bankers League. But it's free to teachers. And it's a vehicle for providing resources and professional development for teachers across the state. And they've been a major push for personal finance, along with the UC Econ Center and the Econ Centers around the state here in Ohio.
And that's in August, correct?
Yes. It's August 3rd through 5th. And the application due date is May 15th.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And how are we doing in terms of being financially literate? Just an interesting example I found was FINRA, an organization you're familiar with, Chris.
The regulatory body for the financial services industry.
They have an investor education foundation. They actually have a national financial capability quiz that's online. It's five questions.
Just five
questions. But here's the surprising thing about this test. They tell you how many you got correct, obviously, but then they show you the national averages. Now, out of five questions, the national average is 2.88 correct. So that means fewer than three right answers. And if I remember right, that would be a failing grade, wouldn't it, Chris?
It's about as close. Depending on what curve you're grading in, it's probably an F in most worlds. So the average is failing, is what you're saying.
Yeah, the average is a failing grade. So does that surprise you, Val?
No, I think that one of the major hurdles that educators have to jump over is the immense amount of material that is available out there on the internet through a variety of sources. And a lot of times educators are not as comfortable with the topic of financial literacy. Then when you're asked to winnow through all of the different pieces of curricula that are available and then teach it, it can be foreboding. So we at the center are committed to provide those free resources to teachers. And we're actually saying to educators, because the free resources that we have available are for grandparents, parents, after school programs, as well as the K-12 environment, the actual physical institutional district. And our point is that we have created a program that's called Smart Path. It's actually made it through the legislative committee through the state of Ohio, 26-0. So it was affirmingly passed and is now part of House Bill 391 to have Smart Ohio, which includes the Smart Path curriculum and educator training, which is the key component, and then also a way to see if it was valuable, which means we have the pre and post assessments that actually allow an educator to teach three lessons and do pre and post assessments at grades 1 through 6. And they will, when they come out on the other end, be financially literate in terms of understanding at their chronological and developmental age what financial literacy really means.
And how do people tap into that?
It is free. It's on our website, economiccenter.org, and go to education, and it's a download. And all of the resources that you need to be successful are there. And we are neutral. We're kind of like the country of Switzerland. We do not affirm any particular bank, et cetera. So we have basically had focus groups with educators to help us create this. It's aligned with the Ohio standards, and it's good stuff. It's just good stuff, and it helps us transform education as we know it today.
Are there any resources on that website or other websites of which you're aware that would be good for parents or grandchildren or grandparents who are worried about their grade school, children or grandchildren, to help those people, to help parents and grandparents relate to their you know, 10-year-olds or 12-year-olds, you know, at their level.
Absolutely. You know, Jumpstart, the Jumpstart Coalition, likewise, which I know Corbin could attest to, has a lot of those kind of parent resources as well that takes that fear out. And the major thing with financial literacy is that it's here to stay. It's not a flash in the pan. It's not something that we'll teach educationally today and then it'll be outmoded or it's not fashionable any longer. It's not a buzzword. It's here to stay. And the sooner that grandparents and parents feel comfortable having that discussion, the better off we all will be and that they don't fall into the same trap that we have.
Yeah, Corbin, go ahead.
That was exactly correct. It has to be that with parents. And sometimes it's not a comfortable conversation with parents and children because maybe the parents themselves have not been financially successful. But even if they are financially successful, sometimes this conversation just doesn't happen. And on the school end, there are a lot of materials out there, and it is a bit of going through those weeds, but a lot of the unfortunate reality for educators in our state is if it's not a requirement or if there's not a test for it, the resources allocated to it, because it doesn't get to our district report card, it gets pushed to the side and it gets put on the, you know, a one-day event. Like there's the real money, real world that the credit unions and the Ohio State Extension offices have. So there's one-day events that you can have like that, but it's that compressed time and the pressure that are put on school districts. So that's why the requirement, the bill, House Bill 383, is out there. As that's one of the unfortunate realities out there. Everybody believes it's an important thing, but it's going through all those materials. What are the materials that are best for you? What are the materials where you can find funding for? And then finding time in the academic day to make it happen.
Corbin, what age are you? Ages are you working with specifically?
It's embedded in our curriculum. It's in the state curriculum and social studies. Starting in pre-K and kindergarten all the way up through 12th grade. Next year, we're going at the high school level. Personal finance is going to be integrated into our year-long government course, where previously it was a standalone course.
So how do young kids react to this? I mean, is this something they can grasp? Did they get the idea?
Absolutely. I mean, the standards are written at a level for the students at each of the grade levels. So there are materials there. There's children's literature books. And sometimes, you know, it's not specifically just a personal finance lesson, even though that's part of the goals. But it could be part of a language arts course, a math course, or a social studies course. But you're still learning those economic and personal finance and money management skills.
We will continue our conversation and we'll take your phone calls at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition. Thanks to Manisha Godbole for listening to 91.7 WVXU today.
On the next On Being, singer-songwriter Craig Minowa of the orchestral indie rock collective Cloud Cult.
We are really blessed as a band because our supporters are seekers. They come to shows with the masks down and with their hearts on the outside.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join us. Sunday evening at 6 on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati.
Support comes from Fairfield Community Arts Center, presenting Juggling Champion Bob Cates, Saturday, April 23rd, 8 p.m. Twice nominated Best One-Man Show, Bob Cates keeps audiences laughing with comedy routines involving advanced juggling, unicycling, magic lasers, and a wild 21 reel plate spinning finale. Tickets at fairfield-city.org/tickets. Support comes from Henderson Music Company of Florence, Kentucky and Sims Township, where you can find new and used pianos by Baldwin, Yamaha, and Steinway, as well as a wide selection of Howard Miller clocks. That's at Henderson Music in Florence, Kentucky and Sims Township on Montgomery Road.
Mm-hmm. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. We're talking about financial literacy, ways to improve it, what both adults and kids should know. Joining me this afternoon, Director for School Relations with the Economic Center at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Valerie Crew, Hamilton City School District ESL Coordinator and Social Studies Coach, and a member of the Teacher Advisory Board with the Ohio Jumpstart Coalition, Corbin Moore, and Chris DeSimio, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Corbin, I take it from what I'm hearing from you, both you and Val, start young. That's the key thing with financial literacy.
Absolutely. The younger you start, the more exposures children have to, and it becomes part of what they do and what they think about when they have money, and they have models from their parents and the models that they talk about in school, either in books or through simulations, the better off we are.
And most children love money. They love money, and they love exchanging it for a good or a service at a very, very young age. So it's very interesting to provide a little one with five pennies and then go in a store and find out what can we buy with that. And, of course, we all know the reality. Penny candy is no longer one of those things afforded to us. But just helping them understand that here's something that you get, and in return, we need to have some money. And children just gravitate towards that. And they are energized by anything that has to do with money. So the major point that we try to make sure that we emphasize to educators is that it's all value added. You can teach math. You can teach math a variety of ways. But if you use coins and money as an introduction, and you use that as your way of teaching math, it has a whole different meaning to a little one versus just counting on your fingers or learning the math skills.
Yeah, and Val and Corbin, you know, from a professional educator standpoint, at what age is it not too early to try to introduce that linkage between working, you know, putting your time into something that you otherwise might not want to do, and getting paid? Is there an age that's ideal for that?
I don't think that it's ever too early. I have a 4-year-old grandson, and he is quite good at communicating what he wants in terms of his choices. He's already learned that there are trade-offs and the logical consequences involved with the choices. And so once a child understands that life is about choices and choices have consequences, they're able to exchange monetarily.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of people.
I would agree with that as well. I mean, if you point out when it happens and the standards, it's grade 2. It basically says that people work to earn an income so that they can make a budget and so forth. But that starts at grade 2. But I agree with Val. It could be at a much earlier age.
Yeah, I'm wondering too, because today you do all your banking online, or at least most of it. You have a debit card or a credit card that you're using to pay for things. So you sort of lose touch with the reality of what money is. Is it a good idea as you're teaching them how to earn and everything, just every now and then have them take out a wallet and actually pay for something?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And once again, this is a developmental thing. So, of course, the average child today that's in elementary might not ever, they might be able to see an actual physical check in the Smithsonian by the time they are old enough to have a checking account. But the point is, right now, that's a tangible way for a child to understand, learn cursive, and a lot of other things.
Instead of cursing.
That's right. Yes, we try to avoid cursing if we can. But it's one of those things that it's developmental. They'll get to that when they need to know it. But right now, it's that process of exchanging a good for a service.
We've learned that in different educational opportunities. For example, when kids are taking a tour of a museum or anything like that, if you have something they can hold and touch and feel, they seem to get it more than just talking about it conceptually. So you give them something such as a coin. They can feel that, and it's more fun than even paper money.
And it's more real.
It's real, mm-hmm. It has weight to it, and it sparkles, and it's shiny, and it's attention getting. So that's interesting.
And even to the point of the global aspect of the world. well, why don't they all just do it the way we do? Why don't they all have nickels and pennies and dimes? Who are these people who are on these other coins? Who are the people who are on our dollar bills? Money is one of those great equalizers where you can teach a lot about history and many, many, many other subjects along the way.
Yeah.
So doing the actual process. You know, the touching, the being a part of the process, even if it's a simulation. I know the UC Econ Center does a stock market game. And being part of it, even if it's just a simulation, that doing it as opposed to sitting back and getting that information makes it come alive for the kids.
Again, 513-419-7100. And let's talk with Joe in Mount Olivet, Kentucky. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
We're a family of five, or we were, and after about the third grade with my oldest daughter, we started homeschooling, and I was listening to a gentleman talk about you can teach this financial security in a multitude of different classes, English, math, history, and it's so true. When our curriculum was basically literature-based, so when they learned about science, government, geography, it was all from reading books. And one of the books that we included in the program was The Richest Man from Babylon. Is anyone familiar with that?
No, I'm not.
I'm not familiar with that one.
The Richest Man from Babylon talks about paying yourself first. And it takes 10% of your income and putting it aside so that eventually, instead of you having to borrow money, you can put your money out there to lend after you have enough money amassed.
That's a great rule. I mean, isn't it? Paying yourself first is probably one of the big principles you should teach kids at a young age.
Right, and I think that really gets back to Val's comment earlier about how it's a choice, it's a conscious choice to forego the gratification of spending all that extra money and saving, whether it's 5%, 10%, 15%, or 20%. You're making a decision now that has consequences both now and later, but it's a great point all the way out there in Mount Olivet, Kentucky.
So thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. You know, we're talking about how you start young. On the other side of the coin, though, is it ever too late to start becoming financially literate? What about grown-ups?
You know, it certainly is not. I'm going to say this loosely, but we have a lot of grown-ups on the University of Cincinnati campus. We have had a dedicated effort in past years to make sure that they're financially literate. You know, they get these things called financial aid checks, and making sure that they go to the actual source of the request for the money versus just spending it on pizza, et cetera. So budgeting never ends. I don't think it ever ends.
And I would say that a lot of folks learn about personal finance through their church. I know a lot of churches use Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University. And there's other programs out there, but I know that's a popular one in the churches where adults get together and talk about personal finance and how that affects their lives.
Yeah. Another important concept is that seeking to become financial literate is something that should never stop, regardless of age, because one of the fastest growing problems is elder abuse and the financial manifestation of elder abuse. And if you think that it can't happen to you, you need to open your eyes, because some financial abuse is very sophisticated and money is gone before you know it. And so becoming smart about all the different things you should be doing and things that should be avoided are things that they don't go away just because you're getting older. They become more acute, in fact, the more birthdays you have in the rearview mirror.
Well, and it sounds
that's
like
something we've been I'm sorry.
Go right ahead.
Something that we've been doing in classes as well is talking about your safety out on the web, not just from a personal standpoint, but the things that you put out there, they live out there and they can be forwarded on, and you know, whatever you put out there that those leaves those crumbs, I've heard on some commercials out there for other people to find, and they put the pieces together and they can get into your accounts, they can file tax returns, fraudulent tax returns and so forth. So knowing what you're putting out there on the web is another piece of personal finance.
Yeah, would you say that the current college student loan crisis that we're seeing, all this student loan debt out there, is a result of poor financial literacy over the past few decades?
I think it's a definite link. I think that putting our head in the sand and just assuming that it would go away or that they would learn through osmosis, et cetera, it just hasn't worked. And fortunately, we are living in a time when it's right there front and center and we're doing a much better job than we were 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Corbin, what do you think?
I think there's a definite link to it. One of the folks I've come across lately is Jackie Cummins-Kosky, and she wrote a book called Money Letters to My Daughter. And it does a nice job of talking about this subject of how do I prepare for college. And it's a kind of a back and forth between a mom and her daughter on how to make those good financial decisions. The more you talk about it, the more efforts we have, the more sponsors we have, the more volunteers we have to go out to churches and schools, the better we are, because you can keep that conversation going and get people to practice and understand what good personal financial responsibility looks like.
Val, I guess, how do I know if I'm financially literate? I mean, if this is something that I want to become financially literate, how do I know when I've reached that level? What things should I be looking at? What area should I be studying? Should I understand basic things, checking, savings? Is that the starting point?
Well, you know, we've all been educated in finance one way or another, whether it was good or bad. The banking industry has tremendous tools. They know that savings, not putting it under your mattress and assuming that it'll be safe there. So any of the materials that you can get your hands on by going hopefully to your bank first and just being exposed to those to take back to your family and have some deep discussions about your budget. They don't need to know every single detail. They don't need to know how much your paycheck is, et cetera. But more information that you can share as a family and you do it together, those are the resources that matter.
Corbin, what do you think? What area should people be looking at if they're striving to become financially literate?
I think it starts with the basic savings account and checking accounts of making a budget. I mean, you have to know how much money is coming in so that you can make that budget and live within your means and have that savings. It starts there and then having that emergency fund so that, you know, if something does come up, what do I do now? And then once you get past that, you can move into investments and add to your knowledge of what it takes to be financially literate.
Well, thank you all for joining me this afternoon.
Sure. It was my pleasure.
You're very welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
Director for School Relations with the Economic Center at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Valerie Crewe, Hamilton City School District ESL Coordinator and Social Studies Coach, and a member of the Teacher Advisory Board with the Ohio Jumpstart Coalition, Corbin Moore, and Chris DeSimio, a financial advisor with Wells Fargo Advisors in Cincinnati. As a reminder, the information provided on today's show is general in nature and may not apply to your personal investment situation.